Today, I'm talking to Peter and Janine Wilson, who are from Esher, about why they're baton bearers on World Mental Health Day on the 10th of October. Baton of Hope represents the UK's largest ever suicide prevention initiative. You lost your daughter Becky to suicide in October 2023. She was just the youngest of your three daughters, aged just 25 years old. Can we talk first about your role as a baton bearer on the 10th and what it involves on the day?
Thanks. Thanks for having us on your podcast, on your show. It's lovely to be here. We applied to be baton bearers sometime earlier on in the year. And what this means to us is an opportunity to stand out in public and say, this is a subject that really needs to be talked about. It's a subject that we want to break the taboo over. It's a subject that we want to have people talking about. It's a subject we want to highlight in society because of the number of people that die from this disease in the UK, or this condition in the UK, every year. I once calculated, I think, that it was one person died by suicide every 90 minutes in the UK. An awful, awful statistic. And if that was true of any other subject, if people were dropping dead of cardiac disease, one every 90 minutes, we'd be jumping up and down. So why aren't we doing that? So being baton bearers for us really means just standing up and saying, we want this to be talked about. We want other people to know, and we want other people to be, if you like, saved from this condition or prevented from ever getting to that point.
The baton itself is actually very beautiful. It's sort of a beautiful sort of sculpture pointing upwards, representing a journey of hope upwards from the depths of sadness that people are feeling they've lost a loved one to suicide. So you're going to be walking a relay starting in Parliament at 9:45 in the morning. What will happen on the day? Janine, do you want to come in on this one?
Yes. Well, on the day, we will be going up and getting in our places because we are situated very close to the beginning of the tour or the route on Friday. So both Peter and I are on the Mall. So Peter's just at Admiralty Arch, and then I'm a little bit further on. So we will get in our place about 10 o'clock in the morning on Friday, and then the relay will begin at Cromwell Green, which is Houses of Parliament, and people will start walking and passing the baton one to another about every 5 minutes or so until they get to the Mall, when we will take up the baton.
So you said you want to raise awareness of mental health. Did your daughter Becky suffer from mental health issues that you're aware of? Do you want to talk about Becky as a person?
Yes, she was lovely. She was lively. But sometimes she just wanted to curl up in a snuggly blanket. She was very friendly, very open and warm. She was a very keen gamer, so she lived quite a lot of her life online. She was also very creative. And one of the things that we discovered even more about Becky after she died was just how inclusive and welcoming and non-judgmental she was. She had a Twitch stream, which if people know what that is, it's a way of playing games online amongst a group of friends. But basically it was named as a place for people to feel safe who don't feel safe anywhere else. And that was Becky, really. She always was welcoming and always wanted to support other people.
This is a hard question to ask. Did you ever feel that Becky would take that path to end her own life?
Well, we realised that Becky had mental health issues probably from her early teens onwards. And she was seen by a number of mental health specialists from that period of time, had a series of diagnoses, and that coincided also with quite a significant burden of physical disease that she also had within her tummy and her joints and also in her muscles, which added to the problem. And the fact that actually she was also going slowly deaf, and all of that was an awful lot for her to cope with. We always knew that there was a possibility that she could take her life, and she'd actually tried on a couple of occasions as a teenager, but not with any great intent. We discussed this with her. We discussed this with her mental health professionals at the time. And they always said that it's a possibility, but it's something that, that it would, if it was going to happen, it would be an accident of her trying rather than any with any real intent. And as she got older, she began to cope with her neurodiversity much better. And the irony was that when she took her life, she was in a much better place than we'd known her for a long, long time. So I suppose the direct answer to your question is, yes, we knew it was possible, but I think we had just simply hoped that it would never happen. When it did, obviously, it was a real tragedy.
Yes, so as a parent, you obviously said you did know about it. She'd had some attempts before, but not realistic ones, as you say.
No.
It's very hard when your young person then becomes an adult and some of her medical information might be withheld from you for reasons that you can't talk about it. And that becomes a difficulty. But did you know how much she was struggling?
You're right. As people get older, there are a number of issues with regards to finding out and knowing what's going on. One, there is obviously patient confidentiality, and health professionals won't talk to parents about mental health disease in their children. And that's an issue that we need to discuss, because often parents are in a position to be able to help. And somebody who transitions from 17 to 18 and then suddenly the flow of information disappears overnight from the health professionals can create a real, real problem. And we're not the only people to have come up against that. And it's something that needs to be debated in order to facilitate and help people as they're moving from being a young adult to an older adult, because at 17 you're still an adult. But she was a private person. She did keep herself to herself. She liked to feel that she could work things out for herself, do things for herself. And to that end, she did keep things from us. And actually, we know that in the week before she died, she was keeping things back from us. And we've talked about this with professionals who've looked at her situation, and they feel that she was probably wanting to protect us from her pain. But at the same time, she was wanting to say to us, I can stand on my own two feet. I'm an adult now. Mm-hmm. I have got resilience. I'm going to keep this to myself so I can work it through. Unfortunately, it was something that she wasn't able to work through by herself. And we look back on that with a degree of real despair, I suppose, or tragedy, that she wasn't able or didn't feel she wanted to reach out to us at that vital point where we perhaps could have helped. She lived in Derby. I'd have been in the car on the motorway within a second.
Mm. Yeah, as parents, I mean, as young people, as you say, transition to young adults, this confidentiality situation is very difficult when you're talking about mental health, because often yourselves, as parents of a young adult, are the ones that can really support you, know how she's grown up, you can recognise the symptoms. And I think you're right. I think something has to be done, particularly in suicide or real mental health issues, where this confidentiality clause that we're stuck with maybe can be alleviated, moved, transitioned to something where a young person and her mental health team that are looking after can bring in yourselves as parents.
I think that there's a lot that we need to think about working as a team with that young person, that it's not just them and their health professional. You know, as you say, they've been brought up in a family where people around them have known them, and we're still on their side and we're still part of their team, if you like, because there's a lot, and we felt that even since Becky died, a lot about advocating for a person with mental health issues and supporting them and helping them gain some confidence.
I think too, there is a difference between capacity and insight. If you have insight, then the law says to a health profession, you can't disclose to somebody else. If you don't have capacity, you can go down the route of sectioning. And that's a very hard thing to do. Mm. I think there has to be a middle way between this, because insight is something that somebody who's on the verge of suicide doesn't completely have, but has something of. So there's this middle pathway where you lose sight of the impact of what you're about to do. You feel that death is the only way out, and it's the only way to get rid of that psychological pain that you're going through, and that you can see no other way of getting rid of it. And they've been through all the tools that they've been taught to stave off that sort of possibility of taking their own life. They've picked up every tool in their toolbox in order to prevent them from going down that route. And the only tool left in the toolbox they've got is that of taking their own life. And it's a tool that should never be there in the first place. It's a tool that if you reach for causes unknown, it's just tragic. It should never happen. But in taking that tool of what saying, I want to end my life, there is a degree to which you're losing your capacity to an extent to understand the implications of what you're doing. And I just would like to talk to health professionals and say, look, there is another way for this. If you really feel that somebody is going to be taking their life, get other people involved who can help. It's not actually breaking confidence necessary to do that, but you're bringing in people who can help to prevent somebody from taking their own life.
I think you've nailed it really with what you've just said there, that it is capacity, it's talking, it's getting you all to work together as a team when you've got a young person who possibly will think about taking their own life. Because if you could only just rewind and talk to them and say, you don't need to do this, there are other options, we're here for you. And yet when they, at the point that person does take their, they are terribly alone, yeah. And they must feel terribly alone. And there must be something in them, maybe you think they're bringing relief to their loved ones by taking themselves off this earth. And that's what's so sad, so terribly sad. It's unimaginable to even try to ascertain your feelings when you lost Becky. But here's a quote from an American humorist, Art Buchwald. It goes, whether it's the best of times or the worst of times, it's the only time we've got, so make the most of it. It sort of sheds a light on your coping mechanism. Can you talk about how you got to this?
Yeah, I read Art Buchwald a little bit. He was a journalist. First of all, he was born in the States, went out to Germany after the First World War, and became a humorist. I mean, ultimately, in the end, his column wasn't particularly humorous, but he did come up with some quotes, and I particularly like this. So I use it as my email signature, as part of my email signature. But basically what it says is, let's be in the moment. We can look back and we can look forward, but we can fail to look at where we are now. So let's be in the moment. Let's make the best and the most of what life is at this point in time. I'm not saying let's go and live our best life and sort of live it up every second of the day. That's impossible, I think. But actually, let's be those who are in the moment at this moment in time. And I think for a subject like that, it's very important. I mean, over the past 2 years, I mean, Saturday will be the second anniversary of Becky's death, the day after we walk for Baton of Hope. And when we look back, we can say, well, we can live in the past. We can live with all the memories. We can live in the comfort of pain, because bereavement creates a little cocoon that you can live in. Or we can live in the moment and say, we've been through this. We never want anybody else to go through what we've been through. Mm. So let's see if we can redeem this in some way. Let's see if we can actually bring this to the public mind in whatever way we can, however small that is, and say, in this moment in time, you can make a difference just simply by listening to somebody who's been bereaved, or by listening to somebody who may be thinking about taking their own life and acting.
That's wonderful. You've both been very involved in raising awareness of suicide by talking about it. And talking about it is the essence of what we're actually talking about now. You have given talks at your local church. You have a great faith and your local GP surgery. So talking is important because we can't stigmatise suicide. We can't be ashamed of it if one of our loved ones has taken that path. It's a reality too many people are having to face. When you've given these talks, has anything come out of it that you've learned that surprised you? Any things you can take from these talks?
One of the things that we've found is that every time we've given a talk, it's just opened doors for people to share their own experience, either personally to ourselves or to the whole group of people that they know and love who've died by suicide or been at risk. And for some of them, it's the first time they've ever been mentioned, and they may be a long way down the line, you know, sort of older people talking about people in their family years ago because of that shame and that taboo that we know still exists. But I think one of the things we found is just that we're not ashamed of Becky, we're not ashamed of what we've done, and that's one of the reasons we've wanted to share. And that's certainly something that's rung true with so many people, that they've been willing to open up.
There is another important stat here, and that is we also know that if you talk openly about what you're going through, and if there's somebody in a group who might be thinking of taking their own life, you reduce the possibility of them doing that by 40%. By 40%. So just by simply talking to people in a group in whom there may be somebody there who's considering that, they've got that tool of suicide in their toolbox, their coping mechanism, they're thinking about it, you reduce the chance of them taking that tool and using it to cope by 40%. And that's one of the main drivers for doing this and talking to other people. Be prepared to talk. It's a real privilege. People have come up to us and said, yeah, this has happened to me. I know somebody it's happened to. And actually being able to talk is a real, it opens doors, but at the same time, it reduces risk.
That's an incredible statistic. So you've hit the nail on the head. Talking about it reduces suicide by 40%, which is huge. I'm going to finish here. Your bravery to talk to me today is incredible, and it'll undoubtedly help many people going through the worry of a loved one struggling with a mental health issue. I said to you, is there a sentence or two that you could leave me to sum up? Can I read what you've just said to me? The pain of bereavement by suicide is real and visceral. It will never go away, but we've found that it gets smaller as life moves forward and grows around that pain. And that's where you are now. You're allowing life to grow again around a sorrow that will remain for your daughter, who you loved very much. It's beautiful. Is there anything you want to add to that?
No, I think for me that sums it up. Mm.
Yes, I think that's true. You can only move forward. And we've been helped and supported by so many different people, but you have to just keep moving forward, even if it's slowly.
We did love her very much,
yes,
but we don't have her anymore. So we've had to ask ourselves, how can we redeem this? And the only way we can do that is by moving forward, by engaging with this, getting others to engage. Mm.
And bringing hope.
And bringing hope. As you said, we have a strong faith, and part of that faith says there is a hope. There is a hope the life to come, but also more importantly, there's a hope in life now.
Hope is a wonderful thing. It's also interesting, our listeners can't see you, but I can see you sitting across from me, and you are both smiling. And to me, to actually, when you've had a tragedy like you've had, to actually be able to start the day and actually say, yeah, I will smile, I can smile, I can remember our lovely daughter for all the good things she brought to us. You can revel in the memories, but you can go on and smile. And that, to me, is a great achievement. It's a great show of your perseverance and your redeeming qualities, and that you're bringing this to other people so they won't possibly have to go through the same. I can't thank you enough. Thank you very much for coming into the studio to talk to me.
Well, thank you for having us, and thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you to both of you.